Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. And today is one of those days where we can celebrate great storytelling and a great storyteller. Dan Barry is a longtime reporter and columnist for the New York Times and the author of several books, including The Boys in the Bunkhouse. And last night, we named him the 2018 Pell Center Prize winner for Story in the Public Square. Dan, thank you for being here and congratulations
on your
prize award. You know, there's so much of your reporting that I think touches people in so many different ways. But there was a recent story that you wrote about the shooting in Florida. And the headline was, "Gunfire erupts at a school. Leaders offer prayers. Children are buried. Repeat." Mm-hmm. Tell us about the story. Tell us about the reporting. Tell us what you did there.
Well, sadly, as singular as Parkland was, it was all too familiar. As a reporter, I've been there before. Do you know what I mean? I've written about mass shootings before, including ones involving schools. And so they all begin to blur together, sadly and wrongly. And there was a thought in the newsroom, I think, by Dean Baquet, the executive editor, challenging us to write about this in a different way. And it just came to the top, this notion of thoughts and prayers, because it suggests that all sides of the gun debate are throwing up their hands, and all that we have are thoughts and prayers, which, you know, delivered the way they are in this kind of rote fashion after a mass shooting becomes meaningless. And so we wanted to echo that and capture that, because I think many people felt exactly that, thoughts and prayers, and we brace for the next one.
There's almost a public and political impotence around this issue. We just can't do it. You've been to other school shootings and mass shootings. How does it affect you as a reporter? How do you do your job in that environment? I think a lot of us, you know, we're sort of glued to the television and we watch this unfold. Actually being there and working in that environment, what's that like?
Well, I've covered a lot of tragedies and catastrophes, and what happens is, and Wayne could speak to this as well, it's kind of a trick of the mind where you're separating yourself. You set aside your feelings. You don't do it consciously. It just kind of happens, and you focus on the moment. You focus on the victims. You focus on the family members. And later on, after you've filed, after you've gone home or to a bar, you decompress, and it's not uncommon to cry. Yeah. And that's what that story was about. And it's interesting, I think the Onion, the satirical website, had a headline that it ran a few years ago, and it was, "No way to prevent this, says the only nation where this regularly happens." Yeah. And it happens again and again. And in fact, the fellow who wrote that was from Parkland.
Oh, wow.
So the themes in that essay, that story of yours, very soon after that story, were embraced by some of the students and other peoples in that movement. But this story came before that. So flying down there, was this already taking shape in your mind that this was the approach, you know, the thoughts, the prayers? I know a lot of people had that reaction again, but it really hadn't been written about, certainly not in this fashion. So the question is, were you already headed down that road as you flew down to Florida?
Well, first of all, I didn't fly down to Florida. It was kind of written on deadline.
Okay,
and so I stayed in the newsroom.
You wrote that in New York, okay.
Right. But if you read the article, you can see that young man, David Hogg, already beginning to express a different kind of sentiment that is capturing the interest and the thoughts of the rest of the country. I think in that article, and this is at the very beginning, he's saying, "We're the kids, you're the adults, you're supposed to be doing something." So you sense his impatience and his fury, and then that's the seed. Okay, all right, it's on us. And so then David Hogg and his classmates, they take it upon themselves to change the national conversation on this.
I want to zero in on something you said here, which is really important for your work or to learn about or describe your work. You said you wrote that on deadline. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is your unique voice, which is stellar.
Right.
it's sophisticated writing on deadline. How do you do something like that on deadline? That's like, you got to go fast.
Well, you know, what happens is the deadlines clarify the mind. Do you know, you don't have any time to horse around. And for me, I don't know about for you, but for me, the hardest part of that process is knowing what the first paragraph or the first two paragraphs are.
Sort of your anchor.
Right. And so once I knew, once we seized upon that notion of thoughts and prayers, and it's almost presented in an, I wouldn't say ironic, but certainly like an exhausted sense, then the rest of the piece follows. And a colleague, Alan Blinder, was helping me report out stuff, and we incorporated it in the piece. So
when we presented you with the Pell Center Prize last night.
By the way, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
I'm going to mention that five more times
before we're done here today.
I'll
keep saying thank you.
but in your remarks, you shared a story about your time as a young reporter with the Providence Journal and an editor who sent you a short message one night that was slow down.
Slow it down.
Yeah.
Right.
So share with our audience that story and how that maybe applies to the reporting on a story like Parkland.
Well, in that situation, I was working on a project, and I'm a creature of deadlines, or I had been. And so if you told me, oh, you have 2 weeks to do this project, that seems like forever. It sounds like an eternity. And so I'd done the research on the project with two colleagues, John Sullivan and Ira Chinoy, and I just wanted to get it in the paper. And I kept, you know, badgering my editor, Tom Heslin, all right, let's put it in the paper, let's put it in the paper. And he sent me, in the old ATEX messaging system, all it said was, slow it down, slow it down. And as I said last night, it really became a kind of epiphany for me. Because you apply it not only to your own life, slow it down and you know, enjoy the moment, but in terms of reporting, you know, I could do a quick interview with you and it's really ultimately meaningless. Or I could slow it down with you and get to know you and notice how you move and notice what you say and notice what you do not say. And then that is a better informed interview that informs and more fully helps the story that results. And so he did help me with that, because otherwise it would have been a forgotten piece, and it wound up being pretty good. So
those three words were sort of not a landmark, but a significant development in your evolution as a writer. Slow it down.
Right. It sounds like, and Tom Heslin said it or wrote it to me, it sounds almost like a throwaway, but
it's profound.
I remember printing it out and keeping it for years.
So in January, you went back again to your ancestral land. You're the child, the son of an Irish immigrant. And you wrote the haunting, agonizing question for Irish, what to do with children's remains. Tell us about that story. And it was the latest or the most recent in a number of stories about the situation.
Right. What happened was that Ireland had a system. The country was effectively created in the early 1920s, and so they were struggling with how to put the government together. And so the social issues, they effectively relegated mostly to the Catholic Church, though with some government supervision. And what they did was, and it was a big deal back then, it was predominantly a Catholic country, and this issue of unmarried mothers really was a big deal. It preyed on the collective thought of Ireland. And so they created these homes. They were called mother and baby homes, where, say, if my mother, when she was 15, in a rural town in Galway, became pregnant, oh, my God, what are we going to do with her? It's an embarrassment to the family. It's an embarrassment to the parish. And oftentimes the parish priest would come and say, Nora has to go. You have to take her to the home. So then often at night, the father would take the daughter to one of these institutions, a mother and baby home, and they would be she would be placed in the care, often with nuns, not always, but often with nuns. And then she would give birth, and then she would nurse the baby for the first year or so. And then at that moment, she would be told to leave, and the baby would stay, okay? And then the baby would grow up to be 4, 5, 6, or 7, and then be placed up for adoption or given to a foster family. And in that case, oftentimes became farmhands. There was like, you know, older couples who had a farm would come and get a young child, often a boy, to help them with the farm. So the kid at 7 or 8 is basically indentured servitude. And or they sometimes would just go to an industrial school. So this is the way it was. And it was all with this overlay of shame, the shame, because there was nothing worse. And the children would be considered the children of the spawn of the devil. So this story concerns one of those homes. There were several in the country. And a local woman in her 60s a few years ago was going to do a nice history about it, sort of like, oh, the sisters were so nice there and they took care of these lovely children. And in the course of her research, and she's an amateur historian, like no academic training really, she sees a bunch of death records. So first of all, this home in Choom County, Galway, was open from 1925 to 1961. And in the course of that time, nearly 800 babies died in that facility. So if you do the math, that's a lot of babies dying. And they're dying because of the spread of disease, gastrointestinal diseases, and all that kinds of thing. And also, they're possibly poor prenatal care. So she finds the death certificates for 798 babies, ranging from infants to 2 or 3. And then she wants to know where they're buried. She can't find out where they're buried. There are no burial records, even though there's a cemetery literally across the street from this old facility. And so this puzzles this woman. Her name is Catherine Corliss. And she keeps digging, and she figures it out through some local stories that have never been published. She's listening to the community. And over the years, people have come across skulls, bones, they've fallen into holes and they've seen like a crypt-like situation. And ultimately what it turns out to have happened is that these nuns buried the children in a disused septic system underneath, under the ground. And that's the story. And so the reason it matters, the reason it's not just a kind of a macabre story from Ireland, it speaks to shame. It speaks to national identity. It speaks to how Ireland is addressing it now. So, and it's a big issue because now they have discovered and they've identified many human remains in the ground, and that facility was knocked down years ago, and now it's a housing project, and there's a playground. So you have children playing above effectively the bones of other children. So what do you do?
Wow.
What do you do? It'll be costly. Can you identify them? There are people who know that their brothers and sisters were buried there. It's a very painful story, and it's difficult for Ireland because it forces Ireland to grapple with its past, where the Catholic Church perhaps had too much sway in the culture. And also now, what do we do with these children?
So I am reminded of a conversation we had a couple of years ago with you about a warden at a psychiatric facility in upstate New York, which had a lot of unmarked graves mm-hmm. as well. In the case of the story in Ireland, how did you find that story? How did you come to report on it?
Well, first of all, it was well known in Ireland. But no one in Ireland had ever written about it in kind of a narrative, long-form way. And so I wasn't holding myself out as having discovered this issue. In fact, Catherine Corliss had discovered it, and it was still ignored. She published it in a journal. It was too shameful for the local community to deal with, and it took a couple of years before it made it to the national newspapers. And even then, people are saying, she's only an amateur. What does she know? There's no proof, but the government began to investigate, and they did all sorts of forensic research and sonar tracking and all that kind of stuff. And in March of last year, the government announced, sadly, there are significant human remains. We believe they're juvenile remains, which is a vindication of Catherine Corliss. And so then my colleagues and I said, what can we do about this? So we went over and spent a lot of time with Catherine. Spent a lot of time in Choom, talked to the people who had found the bones over the years. And I kind of know the culture a little bit because my mother grew up only about 20 miles from there, in a rural stretch of Galway.
And when the Times published this, it was not presented as they didn't serialize it. This was a large pull-out section of the Times.
Right. It was a special section. Yeah.
So how would you respond to people, and I'm guessing there were at least some, who would say, and there are parallels in this country and other countries with history a while ago, who would say, this is history, it happened, it's over, let's just forget it. What's the relevance for something that happened, you know, as early as 1920 to what happened today? How do you respond to that?
Leave me alone. No, I stop calling me.
That's the Irish humor.
Stop calling me. You know, I was worried, Wayne, when the story appeared. I feared that there would be a backlash in Ireland. Oh, here comes a narrow back. Here comes an American telling us about our history. I was really worried about that.
Yeah.
And I have to say that Ireland embraced the story, embraced the telling of it, and recognized that it said something about, not only about people of Ireland, but all people. How do we honor the dead? How do we treat the dead? How the dead remain with us even after they've, years later. And so that's what it was about, and that's usually my answer. And the readership of that story, I referred to this last night, but I didn't specifically talk about this story. That story, it sounds wacky. In the era of Trump, here comes out of the blue a story in the New York Times about an old case in Ireland.
Yeah.
It was one of the 10 most read stories anywhere. That's one. Two, it was about 7,000 words long or so. And the analytics that the Times have done showed that people stayed with it. And a lot of people read it, and a lot of people stayed with it, which is, to me, a reinforcement of the somewhat counterintuitive sense that people want to be told stories. If they're told interestingly enough or well enough or what have you, they'll stay with it. And I think people identified with Catherine Corliss.
It's remarkable storytelling and an incredibly powerful account. But I'm curious, which is, you noted sort of in this era of Trump, we've had other journalists on in the last 6 months who have lamented the fact that it's more and more difficult for them to get their stories published because if they're not writing about Trump, they're not getting run. How do you think that the industry as a whole is faring in this environment?
Do you mean as a business enterprise or in the scrum of covering?
I think in the scrum of covering as sort of as a journalist. I mean, that there are stories beyond Trump that need to be told, like the story from Ireland.
Well, I think, first of all, I think that depends on the news operation. I think the New York Times is a big, big operation, and so there are plenty of avenues for me to write stories that have nothing to do with Trump. And I also think that people sometimes tire of the back and forth between Trump and the person of the day, the target of the day. And sometimes they just want to be told a story, or they want to hear something else that happened in their local community. And so I think that's fine. I think for reporters in this era, the challenge is not to take the bait, okay? If the President of the United States is mocking you, right, to his dozens of millions of Twitter followers, the urge is to respond in kind of a sharp or a sarcastic way. The challenge would be not to do that, to just keep doing your job. Don't, you know what I mean? What was it Michelle Obama said?
They go low, we go high.
We go high.
Yeah.
Right. I think it's important for the integrity of the journalistic enterprise that you try as much as possible to go high always.
So let's talk a bit about your books. You're a distinguished author as well as a...
I'm quite distinguished, yes.
You're extremely distinguished.
Yes, yes.
Talk about The Boys in the Bunkhouse. We talked about that previously, but that was a while ago. That was in some senses similar to the story in Ireland that we were talking about, which is people who were, if not oppressed, were treated poorly. Mm-hmm. How did you find that, and what's the takeaway from The Boys in the Bunkhouse?
Right. So I was writing a national column then, looking for places to go, and I hadn't been to Iowa. And so I read a small article that referred to a group of men with intellectual disability living in an old schoolhouse, working at a nearby meat processing plant for 35 years and making $65 a month for 35 years. They had been neglected. They had been physically abused, verbally abused. And it was finally exposed in 2009. And the article I saw was a reference to a lawsuit that had resulted from this. So I immediately wanted to write about that. And I called up the lawyer who was representing these men. And I said, I want to write about this story. And I was thinking of a column of about 1,500, 2,000 words. I said, but if I do write this column, I would need to speak to the men themselves. And he said, no one has spoken to the men. And I said, why not? And he said, no one has asked.
Wow.
So
wow.
When I, and you know, it's like the slow it down moment.
Yeah.
You say, no one has asked. To me, it represented how society relegates people with intellectual disability to somewhere else, not with us. They're over there. Okay, and you're going to write a story about men with intellectual disability? You talk to their supervisors, or you talk to people who care for them. You don't talk to them, you know, because they have intellectual disability. And I said, no, I got to talk to them. And he said, all right, come on down to come over to Iowa. And I did, and I got to know the men. I got to know their many stories. They had come from state schools in Texas, institutions. Their lives were pretty, quite frankly, miserable and also segregated. And they wound up working for a local rancher, catching turkeys. And then that rancher figured out a business proposition where he would take groups of men and send them to meat processing plants where they would do the worst jobs in a meat processing plant. And that's saying something. That's what happened to these guys. They lived in Iowa for 35 years, but they were Texans. And so I wrote the story. It wound up being a very long story. It wasn't a classic column of 1,500 words. It was closer to 5,000 to 6,000. And I still wasn't done telling their stories. I still had their voices in my head. You know, Willie Levi and Henry and Gene and all these other guys. Each story was individually astounding, and so I wrote a book about it. I think the takeaway is yet again, society has to recognize that people with intellectual disability belong within the community. And we've tried, or society has tried, as Wayne has done, he spent a good part of his career on this issue, including them in society, including them in the community. And I don't think we're quite there yet. And so the book was about that. And also, you know, if I were subtweeting what the book was about, it was, you know, are we our brothers and sisters' keepers? And I say, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Watch out for the vulnerable among us.
Did you always want to be a writer?
Yeah. I think I did. Yeah.
And if you had not been a writer, what would have become of Ann Berry?
I would have become a felon.
I just want to correct the record here. At the age of 6 months, he didn't want to be a writer. It started, I think, at the age of one, right?
It's a very precise term.
Yeah. I don't know. I have no idea what I would have become. Probably a ne'er-do-well. I had no option B.
There was no plan B.
There was no plan B, no.
Well, thank God you did. You have another book coming out soon,
right?
In September, if I'm correct. Tell us about that quickly, because
about 45 seconds.
45 seconds.
All right, very quickly.
thank you. And now it's time to go.
I spent a decade for the New York Times, traveling around the country, writing about, say, the boys in the bunkhouse, but all sorts of things. You know, the Munchkin from the corner from the Wizard of Oz, or a gathering of burlesque retired burlesque queens, all sorts of things that said something about America. And this is a book called This Land, America Lost and Found, and it's a collection of those columns from all around the country.
Sounds great.
And that's going to be out
In September.
In September. Well, we'll look forward to it. Dan Barry, thank you so much for being with us. He's the 2018 Pell Center Prize winner, and he's also, oh, by the way, with the New York Times. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, please find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org, where you can also catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.